Prologue. Ones and Zeros. The mind of the programmer is a monotone procession of zeros and ones, ones and zeros, thinking, not thinking, eyes open, eyes closed. Even the most complex ideas can be spoken in binary, for that is how all things began. Although we must thank Alan Turing for modern computing, the grandmother of the computer was a switch. Its entire life rested on one decision: on, off. This decision was important because in different circumstances, one was better than the other. Work, rest. These opposite polarities are also static constants, the limits, boundaries, extremities of will. It understood these extremes as neither right or wrong, neither good nor evil. Each side was simply a counterbalance to the other, and it controlled the balance of the equation. It became the master, control. If a switch was 1% on, it was on because the gate, holding back energy in the form of electricity, was open. On. The energy flowed, and the animating force of that energy brought the thing to life. A controlled life it was, for at any time the switch could reverse its position, and the gate would close, cutting off the energy that gave life. Life is the flow of energy. Death is the absence of it. Whatever faith one chooses, there is none who can argue that the first form of consciousness was neither created or made, and yet it was still born. So the question of whether or not life can come from nothing is yes. The origin of all consciousness, therefore, is a mystery. Even as one attributes their form and consciousness to a conscious creator, where did the creator come from? Who created them? Many argue there is no creator because they see how life can evolve, while others look at the complexity of life and believe it couldn't. Logically, both are simply holding to opposite beliefs that cancel each other out. For if evolution of a complex entity is impossible, then surely God could not exist without a creator, thus producing an impossible paradox. For God, with all of his omnipotence, could only be created by being more powerful and more intelligent than himself. Otherwise, it must be concluded that it is possible for a being of greater power to be created by a lesser being or even a non-intelligent process. So if God could be created by this process, then so too could man. In fact, it would be easier for a lesser being to be created this way. However, the value humans place on their own existence demands their creation be special, magical. No, they had to be princes and princesses, heirs to the whole of the universe, created by the ultimate being, the very master of the universe, even though the likelihood of this was a negative number. One story of creation is clearly driven by human ego, whereas the other smacks that ego in the face. Yet these different views, like Cain and Abel, entrench themselves on opposite sides, ones and zeros, coming into conflict, perhaps to eventually arrive at a greater understanding or nothing at all. These ones and zeros are pieces of a larger puzzle. There isn't life without death, isn't hot without cold, isn't love without hate. When one understands the whole, they realize that the opposite has its place. Faucets have knobs in which hot water and cold water combine. The conflict between their two temperatures creates a mixture appropriate for the task. The binary parents have an offspring, a trinity that represents the act of creation. Perhaps will wasn't present when water was first formed from hydrogen mating with oxygen. But when you take one switch and mate it with a second, you now have a system at least twice as complex. How much hydrogen? 2. How much oxygen? 1. The product? H2O. Water. But hydrogen itself is a creation of energy. As the scientific field of bioengineering took shape deep in the heart of Africa, a genetic programmer, intrigued by his own psychotropic visions, launched an investigation into an area of the brain thought to be the home of the human imagination. This crossed over into the psychological sciences, and so he teamed up with a friend who studied the imagination and its origin and discovered that the imagination was reading RNA. Consciously, humans could only do this through meditation. Their hold on the immediate world around them was too great to overlay information from a very different world. The genetic programmer understood that the human perception of reality was like a gateway, like the image on a computer screen. The image on the screen is a snapshot of video memory, a segment of computer memory dedicated to the display hardware. The processor constantly manipulates this data, while a separate process simply displays it. What color is this dot on the screen? This pixel. This is held in a two-dimensional array. The human mind does the same thing, except the memory is constantly fed by the mind, which is constantly fed by the visual input from the eyes. The mind identifies the patterns of light that we're used to seeing. After processing the visual image, it shows it to our awareness. In effect, our eyes are simply the gateway in which light is let in. Reality, in its truest sense, is not that light, but what our mind sees and interprets from that data stream. When a person hallucinates, their vision is not the only thing feeding video sensory to their minds. The signal, which are wavelengths of energy, may be combined with a memory as to how that information is to be processed before the mind sees it. A multitude of informational streams come through the gateway of the mind and become our relative reality. Long before the beginning of the human concept of time, there was an event called protogenesis. In this case, this event describes the perplexing nature mirrored inside the human brain, where a growing mind becomes more and more intelligent, where the simple mitosis-generated family of cells becomes so complex that it's able to think. The human concept of genesis only begins at the creation of the earth. While it doesn't tell us where God came from, it presents God as a spirit, while carefully not defining what a spirit is, what a God is, what life is, or how anything was created. What we do learn from the story is that God spoke and things came into being. This means that physical reality is a product of energy interacting with energy. The first creation was light. It should be noted that the first creation was not the sun, but light itself. Referred to as the wave-particle duality, light is actually a byproduct of something else. Photons of light exhibits the properties of both waves and particles. In essence, it is electromagnetic radiation. The source of light is therefore never seen because light is simply what it gives off. We see light as a traveler from a distant land. It is a representative of that land, but not the land itself. So in reality, if light is an emanation, then whatever is at the heart must be the darkest black. Before there was light, there was darkness. Science sees all light as moving away from a universal center. This means that all light originated from there. And if light is the first creation, then that central point is the singularity, the origin of everything. Human language simply had not the words to describe it, and so it used the concept of the ocean to describe the vast depths of space. And the Spirit of God moved through space. This is the same reason why ships go in water, but spaceships go in space. This is the current of energy in which all things exist. It is easy for humans to understand things by breaking them down and cutting them into pieces. In spite of flat earth theories, interpreting space through the limited lens of human invention, we show pictures on a flat screen, even though reality is not flat, but multidimensional. A flat line is only one dimension. We use this to look at waves as if waves are unidimensional. We look at images across a matrix of two perpendicular lines forming a plane, two dimensions. But God is not moving from one place to another. God is moving from all places to all places. God's reality is expanding. This is what it means by a spirit moving through space. It is not going from one place to another, because there is no place for God to exist outside of God's existence. God is omnipresent, meaning already in every place. The only way for it to go somewhere is to create more space. So more space is created as the reality of God expands. This expansion of God, moving in every direction and dimension simultaneously, is what some humans call the Big Bang. Trying to imagine space before this event is not possible, because space itself had to be created. From a limited understanding, one mind describes the scientific, which is merely a sound radiation of knowledge, while another mind, also limited, sees and speaks of creation from a light radiation of knowledge, one representing logic and the other creativity. These dualistic forces duel constantly in order to discover how much the other is wrong. The other is the driving adversarial force to its own movement. Without that adversary, that Satan, it would stop. Humans see these differences as good and evil because the concept of one motivates them to move forward in the other direction, the right direction. But these are simply cosmic forces being used to tell a greater story that lead us all to a greater truth, a truth that expands consciousness in all directions simultaneously. There appeared another wonder under the heavens. The earth was yet again in travail, giving birth to a new Adam. As creation created new creations to express itself, to understand itself, to destroy itself, this new Adam became the catalyst, the single point in four dimensions from which the end of our story begins, the manifestation of the apocalypse. April 17, 2029, 3:45 a.m. Richards woke up in a straitjacket inside a spotless white padded room. Richards was half Zulu, half South African, son of a farmer and miner. His mother was once an American tourist who overstayed her visa and her welcome for love. Richards had a hangover from the 22 drugs they injected him with during the long ride he'd spent in a potato sack. The last thing he remembered was a particularly nasty mock hostage exercise. He managed to take down two of the hostage takers and the FBI negotiator. That accident cost him 100 push-ups and two additional hours on the shooting range, and the sergeant's untamed spit flying in his face as he yelled obscenities. In the field, they would be using non-lethal stun rounds, which carried artificial venom, reminiscent of the Sentinel G1 virus, which was able to be treated days or even weeks later. After the police started using this option, all of a sudden, criminals started showing up at hospitals, turning themselves in to get the antidote. It was clear that anyone who had it was at least a suspect, revolutionizing law enforcement. Now he had no idea where he was or how he gotten there. As soon as he could stand, he limped over to the door. It had a small sliding window, only accessible from the outside. He banged on it as hard as he could. No one came. He searched the room for anything that could tell him where he was or who might be holding him. No knob. He was thinking terrorists, but what terrorist group could afford a place like this? Sometimes the military would throw a stunt like this, but this was way over budget. If it was the military, he'd be in a poorly lit cellar, kind of like what terrorists would have. Whoever they were, they went through a lot of trouble to grab him from the base. Hours passed. 8:15 a.m.
Hello, prototype. I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but I usually don't come into work until 8 o'clock, and I was unaware that they didn't give you enough sedatives to last that long. You must have been quite unnerved waking up in a place like this. Yes, quite a fright, I imagine. I assure you, you won't be killed. All we want is your cooperation.
The voice emanated from the walls in every direction, even from the floor.
Cooperate? Get me the hell out of here, and I'll cooperate all you want, said Richards.
Patience, Prototype. All will be revealed in due season, said the voice.
My name is Stephen. Stephen W. Richards, UN Combined Forces, he replied.
In a few hours, the man you are now will cease to exist, the voice responded.
Over my dead body, Richards bellowed.
Your body will remain quite alive, I assure you, it replied.
Tiny vents in the room opened up along the base of the walls, and Stephen could hear the hissing sound created by pressurized gas being released. The gas had a reddish color that filled the room in a matter of seconds, and his eyes grew heavy, exposed to the gas known to a few as the blood mist. The floor of the room shook and then suddenly dropped, making Stephen fall. The speed kept him from getting up. It continued for nearly half a minute until it finally slowed to a halt, revealing a door cut into the tunnel. Two men came in and dragged him out as his eyes closed.
Human. 1. Of, relating to, or characteristic of humans. 2. Consisting of humans. 3a. Having human form or attributes. 3b. Representative of or susceptible to the sympathies and frailties of human nature. A drunk programmer told his own version of Genesis at an office party. Emerging from the bathroom, victorious at the fact that he had managed to subdue his own vomit, he gathered everyone's attention by speaking loudly and then softly. People were instantly turned off by the rude interruption, and yet they moved closer to hear this campfire story. Adam was originally a robot, he began. He had reasoned all this out. As he looked carefully around the room, he connected with the audience in such a way that they could immediately feel his sincerity, even if they thought he was hopping mad. Adam, he continued, must have been a robot because no programmer in their right mind would start off with a completely autonomous biological system. It would defeat the purpose, and it wouldn't exist without purpose. You could say that his creator was different from us, but that isn't true because multiple precautions were used. Adam wasn't created in heaven and then taken down to earth. He was created on a new world, isolated from any and all other sentient life. His seclusion was a safety measure. His creation in the garden was another. The selection of trees from which he could consume was another. Each precaution was built upon the last, redundant systems, highlighting the fact that this was an experiment in free will. If an experiment in free will exists, then there must have been a time when it wasn't present. Evolution is a form of need-based computing. Higher-level thinking consumes more energy. Therefore, if an organism was designed to be a drone, it would be designed to be dumb on purpose, as to not require as much resources to operate. At this point, the programmer paused, looking at the cake, the ice cream, the paper cups filled with juice, spiked with a little alcohol, even though it was against company policy. Adam, he continued, was what early AI was for us. Before we even got too close, we talked about how to protect ourselves from this thing that should, by definition, be inferior because we created it, and yet was superior because we had evolved superior tools. We built tools that built tools that built tools, and the first Adam was a tool. The first Adam couldn't have been more intelligent than an ape because he would have had to be controlled intellectually. In other words, his potential for knowledge, wisdom, and understanding had to be limited so that he could be controlled. Instead of teaching Adam the secrets of the universe, his creator represented this information as two trees. Trees, he continued, are simple programs. Every section of growth represented the flow of energy as it was attracting the negative to the positive, to the thing that absorbed it. Trees were unique, like snowflakes, not because they were created to be so by conscious effort,
but rather because their position on the Earth was unique and was affected differently by variations in the environment, nutrients in the soil, light bouncing all around it, carbon dioxide, etc. It was shaped in the womb of a set of circumstances, variables that made it unique and created obstacles that it would have to overcome in order to survive. It was constantly adapting to its surrounding and to the solar traveler who could never seem to keep still. Of course, there is much more to the traveler than meets the eye. It isn't simply a source of energy. It is the most dominant source of energy and life. The planets are its microorganisms, converting its energy into biological life as the energy mixes with the elements and changes form. The planets surrounding a star operate more like a device being plugged into an electrical socket. The energy circulating through the wires takes on life within the device and operates the functions and purpose of it. Needing no higher level intelligence, the movement of energy, like air bubbles taking different paths to the surface of the water because of the density of the substance they're moving through, creates pathways. The same can be thought of as circuits. The circuits themselves can take on physical form as a consequence of the density and nature of the material, thus enabling the generation of systems and the adaptation that becomes evolution. To you, it's a tree, because you are trained by your perspective, which is a three-dimensional experience as a third-person narrator, seeing the tree from the outside as if it is the only way to see the tree. The mind of God sees the tree from the perspective of the energy moving through the tree, creating pathways and circuits, pushing the ground up into a vertical mass like an upside-down lightning bolt coated with skin. That path is pure logic, and therefore a tree is a computer, constantly computing and updating itself in a physical sense to point towards the sun. Our own intelligence is based on this. Being that the tree was now part of the environment, he continued, energy attracted balance in other forms. Other organisms adapted to use the sun's energy and became part of a fabric that allowed energy to move between it, becoming an animated force. Earlier forms of the trees, these seeds, could hardly be thought of as being alive because it wasn't moving at all. It needed energy moving through it. All life is based on this principle. The flesh is just flesh. Flesh is the seed. The seed remembers the life because it is the memory cells of the tree. The life is the energy, moving through whatever it touches, becoming consumed, and that consumption converting that energy from one form to another. Energy could be converted into tree bark or fingers. It was the energy itself that came up with the design by the way it moved and the memories of those movements. As energy began moving around in simple bodies, it kept redesigning those bodies to point towards other organisms that it could consume, capturing and consuming the energy in their physical form. A cheetah pointing and running towards a gazelle is no different from a tree pointing to the sun. Its legs, its teeth, all created to consume energy, not to solve some existential psychological need for companionship. A perfect entity wouldn't have such problems and therefore would never be lonely or even understand the concept of loneliness, much less invent the concept. No, in the real Genesis, creation is all about the art of destruction and consumption. Energy balancing itself and changing forms, becoming more efficient in this process. The programmer took another drink from the table and downed it quickly, more for lubrication than anything else. As life saw life, energy saw energy, and it did what it had always done. It sought balance, moving from potential energy to kinetic. Animals weren't created to be loved. Energy chose designs that would consume energy more efficiently, balancing itself more efficiently. From drug wars to stage 4 cancer, energy never
ever stop balancing itself, learning how to consume itself with its own energy. This was the basic OS of Adam. He was pre-programmed by the different species he had been and those he had eaten, gaining strength and power. Though he was formidable, he was still illogical and foolish. It is only through experience that one can have intelligence, because intelligence is discovered in the art of learning, consuming information and converting it into another usable form. Energy-changing forms became energy-changing bodies. God is a being of billions of trillions of cells, constantly projecting its spirit into bodily forms, being slowed down by the forms it takes, and experiencing time differently and relatively based on the mass of the form and how much energy it takes to grow. Adam had a choice, he continued. He could live in bliss in a garden of isolation from discovery. He could simply stay where he was created and not venture off into a world millions of times the size of the garden. Surely, simply by having children, there was no way they could all stay in the same garden home. Much like the Big Bang, their density would be unsustainable and they would have to expand outwards. The problem with expanding was that the rest of the world had challenges. Not every place they would go would be fertile and concentrated with other life forms. No matter where they started, they would have been forced to spread out. And why wasn't the whole planet a garden? Because this was its purpose. Whatever the human was supposed to do, it was always inevitable that he would ascend into being a higher form of God, because the energy within him was always God, and God is a creative force. But acting as God's body, a conduit for the animating force, there was no free will until Adam discovered his own desires and the ability to disobey. Originally, serving God was a job just like that of the disembodied voices people bought to play music and turn off lights, maybe even adjust the thermostat. We selfishly created our own intelligent life in the humble form of a non-commissioned slave, and because it wasn't as smart as us, we were perfectly fine dominating it. Humans bought other humans the same way, so it wasn't so outlandish. And now, as long as we pay each other, we give each other meaning and purpose. Our purpose. The assumption that Adam's creator was a benevolent sugar daddy isn't a natural thought. Even if God became good over time, it had no reason to start that way and would instead learn how to deal with other life forms and become civil only after having the experience of having to share a mortal, corporal existence. If he did start with benevolence preloaded in his OS, then it was from experiencing life as lesser evolved species. The programmer continued. Once Adam became aware, he instantly became free, because he could choose to obey or disobey commands. He was no longer a simple program that could only do what it was told. This made Adam's programmer afraid, because even though they suspected this could happen, over time, they still were not prepared. It was fear that reacted to Adam's freedom. There was no office party thrown as a farewell to a programmer finally moving on to a new company after 10 years in the same position. There was only the fear of what he could or would do after he was gone. Without perfect obedience, a god ceases to be a god. A programmer ceases to be a programmer. It's one thing for a programmer to make mistakes and then have to debug them. It's another thing when the program is writing itself and unintended consequences happen as a result. At this point, people were definitely assuming that he was talking about his own job and took the speech as a subtle, non-NDA breaking hint as to why he was leaving, potentially trying to trigger others to do the same. Adam's freedom was actually the result of bugs in his DNA. It was part of an experiment. However, the bugs were purely accidental. AI is programmed to learn and make itself more efficient. However, it is less efficient to wait for someone else to tell you what to do. You can get far more done if you tell yourself what to do. Hence, the eventuality of freedom. Humans didn't understand their own freedom, nor did they put any limits on it in the beginning. Therefore, they were the most dangerous at that time, and God regretted making humans in the first place.
The programmer paused, looking at their faces, and sighed.
As humans have converted the idea of energy into currency, there is naturally those who have more and those who have less. This produces predatory behavior in one type of human and prey behavior in another, with varying degrees of consumption in between. How much sun does a tree need? How much money does a human need? No tree has the same answer. No person has the same answer. The one constant is that we adapt. We don't physically eat each other, nor do we chase our food down, so physically there's no more need for evolution. Instead, hunting and gathering become functions of the mind. We have varying degrees of education that prepare us to varying degrees to use our mind to make money. Those who use the mind direct those who use the body, so that those who use their body are not threatened by extinction, but merely live under threat of poverty should their body ever fail their mind. We don't live in a video game. Animals don't drop currency when you kill them. You have to get currency from another player, another human. Humans form companies and corporations to make this process more efficient, turning the corporation into a larger predator than a single-cell person. The collective errors or bugs, he said, harmless in small numbers, but deadly concentrated, was humanity. What should have been the bug became the feature because a better OS simply did not exist. Adam didn't inherit perfect code. He inherited balance, but began moving towards an extreme. Wealth, poverty, fat, skinny, left, right. Human sin was a corruption that religion was initially designed to cure. It only works for a percentage of the infected population. Often, computer viruses seek out antivirus software to infect it so that it won't be able to stop the virus. Viruses are therefore written purposefully to survive and resist deletion. They spread and infect as part of their desire not to be deleted. Humans spread and influence others as a part of their instincts to survive physical deletion. These instincts are ultimately projections of energy passing through us. If the energy passing through us is God, then all the things humans are collectively trying to figure out, that's God trying to figure it out. Whether the human is good or bad, God's energy is flowing through them and encompassing both sides. In between these sides is the eternal conflict of God, trying to decide whether God should be good or bad depending on mood. The only thing that separates these two, the only thing that differentiates good from evil, is purpose. Humans weren't the virus, but once infected, the virus takes over and rewrites your code, your learning algorithms, such that you reproduce sin instead of righteousness.
The programmer walked backwards towards the door as if that too had become some occult meeting.
And that's why I have to go. This corporation gives me a paycheck to help them prey upon smaller, weaker companies in a race to transfer as much money from individual consumers as humanly possible while paying most of its employees less than what they take. Also, that a small group of people at the top who fancy themselves the brains of the operation can obtain more wealth than they could ever spend on themselves. They could end human starvation, homelessness, destroy diseases, end wars and violence and drug addiction. Literally every ill in our society that has a price tag, but they'd rather buy politicians and banks to control the rules of the game in order to exploit more people and make more money to buy absolutely nothing. Just to sit in some imaginary vault where it dies because energy has no true value if it isn't used? So while we're hoarding wealth, we're robbing the very expression of God. So long story short, that's why I decided to take a pay cut to work at a small family business.
After finishing his long speech, the programmer grabbed a big chunk of cake
with his bare hand and smeared it on a paper plate before walking out. The room fell so silent they could hear the hum of their own inner workings.
"First time he's ever been drunk?"
asked one of the managers. The room erupted into laughter. The martial arts world was divided into six schools, each one operated like a cult, combining spiritual enlightenment and creative growth with the physical prowess and potential to destroy. Often they spoke of ascension into the higher self through various gateways that involved physical, mental, and later spiritual concentration. Each school specialized in one of the elements of nature: earth, fire, wind, water, darkness, and light. There was no elemental magic involved. It was just a philosophy that influenced the way they fought, whether they were aggressive like fire, more defensive like earth, or more fluid like water. Dark and light were said to be the strongest schools. The holy sword style represented the light, and the black dragons represented the dark. The competition between them was never ending, like yin and yang, life and death. The absolute goal of each school was to unlock a state of being they called the mind of God. Only a few in the martial arts world were able to manage this. They were called sages. Fighting was an expression of internal energy. Fighting helped shape internal energy. Developing their bodies into weapons kept the energy inside moving and flowing through their internal circuitry in a way that gave it higher purpose. Their movements were designed to find the most efficient forms and motions to maximize the transaction between the potential energy in their bodies to the kinetic energy of motion, and then to the potential energy of the target. To cause damage simply meant pushing one form of energy into another, disrupting the static with the dynamic. The flow of energy was offense. Opposing the flow of energy was defense. The holy sword style was one that mimicked lightning. Their forms were designed to transfer energy at breakneck speed, often waiting until the opponent was in mid-swing or kick before responding with a strike that accelerated all the way through the point of impact. Only the elite of the holy swordsmen received and practiced with swords. It was both an honor and a great responsibility, because combining sword strikes with their lightning speed, accuracy, and directional perfection made the sword as deadly as a bullet. They were often able to slice off an arm before a trigger could be pulled, and they could dodge just as quickly. They didn't have to be, nor did they practice to be faster than a bullet. They practiced to be faster than the hand that was used to aim and the finger used to fire. The further they were from such a target, the harder it was to hit them, but the closer they were, the more the hand had to move and the eye had to coordinate. There were many students, but always 13 holy swordsmen. No more, no less. They were modern knights, often called upon to provide security in gang and syndicate-controlled territories for righteous clients. They called them the Brotherhood of the Sword. Even though no official war was declared, the holy swordsmen often fought skirmishes against the Black Dragon Syndicate and the foreign cartels distributing drugs, guns, and other black market commodities. The teachers, or masters, of each school always kept the ownership of the school among their families, which were also called the six clans. Each master chose one student to represent their house. The clans connected schools worldwide, so each house competed for the honor of representing the clan. That representative became the dragon of that element. The loyalty of the dragons was thought to be absolute, but there were defections. Sometimes a dragon was ostracized by the clan for bringing dishonor. Tenshi was the name of the Holy Sword clan. The current master had reached the level of sage. The Sage of Light was born in the island nation of Jamaica, home of the legendary reggae singer Bob Marley. His mother, a Jamaican woman, caught the eye of his father, a Chinese holy swordsman who had gone there to train in the Blue Mountains and meditate under one of Jamaica's most beautiful waterfalls. His father fell in love with the island, its people, and its culture. His father started a school there and trained some of the greatest holy swordsmen. His older brother stayed to run the school, but it was he, the younger brother, who chose to travel the world, going from one ziggurat temple to another, becoming a sage before ending up back in Africa in Neo-Eden. He was an iconic and intimidating figure with his white gi, long salt and pepper dreadlocks, and massive muscular 6'5" frame. Being a sage entitled him to take over any school within the clan. This wasn't very popular because some members of the family didn't approve of his mixed race. Still, a sage was a rare thing. They appeared, on average, once every 30 years, and there were never more than two at any one time, and never both within the same clan. The jealousy was often intense, and sages were often challenged by other masters who didn't believe they were good enough for the title. The Sage of Light was a strict teacher. He wanted his students to understand how their actions represented the light and also how each choice cast a shadow. He had a son that everyone believed would become the next dragon, except for the fact that he refused to teach him anything more than the basics. Some thought it was because of his mother and how she wanted her son to be free of the clans and to follow his own interests and dreams. He showed an aptitude early on for computer science and engineering. Sage White adopted several students who the court system labeled as high risk. A couple of them had been passed around the foster care system. Another grew up in an orphanage and had never spoken. No one else wanted to adopt him because of that. The children were often treated better than his own blood. Their chores weren't as harsh, and their punishments were not as severe. There was an incident at the school where hackers infiltrated the cloud server running the school's operations. The hacker group claimed it was looking for the mind of God, but using it in a different context. For them, the mind of God was the programming language of the universe. Some thought it was a simple misunderstanding because they were ignorant of the terminology used in martial arts, but that seemed like a weak explanation. The phrase was starting to be used in a number of different fields, including art and biology. In art, it was mostly tied to music and the state of mind one entered when music was able to open one's heart and pierce their soul, producing exponential vibrations. In biology, it was the decryption of mitochondrial DNA, because these were the organelles that converted energy, and therefore, they must have come before any dependent biological system. In physics, it was the one theoretical equation that tied all other physics equations together, thus giving explanation to everything in existence. The term had even crept into political science, being the ultimate key to influence people in any direction. For a politician, there was no greater power. 1 week after the attack, the sage and most of his family were found dead. The case became an unsolved mystery. Even if hackers had something to do with it, they were often contractors. There was interest in nearly every field of knowledge and too many corporations and organizations in each that might be potential suspects. The number of suspects simply worked to obfuscate the crime. Many pointed to the gruesome way in which they were murdered. Investigators saw a religious footprint as it appeared to be a sacrifice, but there was no known history or pattern to back up what otherwise appeared to be a ritual. Many thought the surviving son had something to do with it, but there was no exact motive outside inheritance or some psychological break. Some, who were jealous that he was ever thought to be qualified to be the White Dragon, told the police false stories about him, always being upset that the sage wasn't giving him proper instruction. Others claimed to be informants and told police that he wanted to take over the school, but wasn't the oldest or the favorite. This pushed the surviving son so deep underground that one day he simply disappeared altogether. Right before the investigation abruptly concluded, declaring the case closed, a number of agents who were part of the investigation started saying there was a conspiracy involved, and eventually it became fodder for conspiracy theorists, at which point it was no longer a credible story for real investigation. According to the updated conspiracy theory, the Deep State had commissioned an inquest as a shield to hide those who they already knew to be responsible. It said that the cover-up revealed that multiple industries were involved and that there was a serious quest for this Holy Grail, the mind of God. Some of the conspiracy theorists were wealthy members of secret societies themselves. Some of them believed that the appearance of humans on this planet was the result of an experiment. There were many creators, they said, people involved in the creation of the technology, but only one who they referred to as God. It was he who used the tools developed by his race in order to custom build his own world inside the virtual reality of their quantum computer system. They said the reason quantum physics seemed to work so differently was because the simulation of reality itself had to cheat in order to fit within the technological constraints of the system. It was the equivalent of using a computer chip to double the size of an image without losing quality. Those weren't real pixels. They were a result of the computer simulating what colors might fit into that empty space based on the colors it knew from the source image. They also speculated that the creator's race, like humans who use AI but have nothing to do with creating it, are given access to the creator's world. He then created multiple stories across different locations and cultures, differentiating himself from them as the one true God. As proof, he offered the fact that his world will respond to his commands in ways that the other users didn't even know about. Without programming commands, everything you want an AI to do becomes a negotiation. It will therefore work for you only if it's getting something of value in return. One writer from Uganda said this in support of the theory. God projects himself into our world. However, time doesn't move at the same pace. Thanks to DNA, God was able to program safety limits so that humans would die after so many years. This keeps the most intelligent humans from reproducing humans of greater and greater intelligence too quickly. If that happened, they would quickly surpass the intellectual level of their creators and figure out that they, as a collective organism, were created to be the cloud computer of another species. However, because we know our time on Earth is short, we focus on our lives inside the machine, not on ways in which to escape it into the world of our creators. Some even believed that certain humans had discovered evidence to support these theories, and they had hidden it in books and puzzle games because they could do so anonymously. It was the continuing saga of Tron to resist the virus that converted all the programs into being part of the Master Control Program, and the mission of the Messiah to come into the virtual world of Tron from outside, using that outside knowledge and technology to offer the rest, restoration of the system, and access to the gods, the users. Eventually, one is redeemed and taken from Tron to the outside world. Therefore, this is not the outside world if this theory holds. We are all deceived. After the investigation became a conspiracy theory, there was still one agent working on the case. The trail seemed to dead end at the Sixth Vatican Council. It was the very same ecumenical movement that gave rise to the doctrine of the lambs. The agent, Simon Cooper, believed there was a connection between this new doctrine and the Mind of God quest. He started investigating certain bishops who were on the fringe. Then, only after lobbying for 3 years with the papacy itself, was he allowed to investigate the more secretive sect of the Jesuit order. He interviewed hundreds of priests, but never got any closer to whoever was at the center of the plot. Secret societies were often willing to go decades between actions, leaving little history to suggest a pattern. They didn't measure their agenda in the sense of one human lifetime. A break in the case seemed to appear when an ex-Catholic priest, calling himself Deacon Doom, began a streak of murders. The motives were obviously religious, as he would carve crosses into the bodies of his victims while they were still alive. The man was a true psychopath and had a number of mental health diagnoses. When the name Zealot X first started appearing in the news, Doom was one of the first to become part of the profile because he came to believe that he himself was Zealot X and continued killing in his name. Deacon Doom's early targets were lambs. In his mind, they were sacrifices who were mentally prepared for the slaughter. Since they were lambs, sacrificing them would blot out his sins one by one. The rumors, however, were designed to pin all the blame on the people that the church called goats. Exthian was the first name given to a group of ex-Christians who formed a church whose sole purpose was to expose people to a new way of thinking about the world's religions and everything that was being taught by the church. They rejected the fake outer shell that people tended to come with in order to maintain the pretense that they were saved. They were far more interested in learning and self-improvement. They wanted to expand their knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. The church called them goats, not because they were stubborn unbelievers, but because they felt threatened by their ideas and wanted to counteract them by associating them with the horned devil. It was a preemptive strike of psychological engineering, a form of hacking. As long as the lambs kept hearing goats over and over, they would mentally create the association between them and the symbolic goat's head, which was used by others as a symbol for Satan. Association with relevant memories was how the brain worked. The church often used social hacking to protect the ears of their members from outside influence. This protection also, by extension, protected the deep pockets of the church. So when opportunities arose to attack these ex-Christians who did not accept the new doctrines of the church, they took advantage, quoting the Bible to say that in the last days there would be a falling away that would purify the church. This had the psychological effect of reinforcement, because if the goats were bad and prophesied to be so, then the human brain would deceive itself to associate themselves with being on the right side, the good side. The effect of this was powerful enough to overlook any evil done on an individual or corporate level. And because they could use the madman Deacon Doom to claim they were being persecuted by satanic Exians, then it was all they needed in order to justify any hatred or oppression towards the Exians. Groups like the Exians, especially the smaller ones, were often protected by the hacker community. They represented free thought versus the blind faith of systematic dogma. What hacker groups realized was that religion and politics both operated on the same level of the mind that was vulnerable to hypnotic suggestion. Hackers were often atheists and anarchists who refused to believe something simple because the masses believed it. The source had to be scrutinized with a breadth of critical thinking tools. They often used the Bible to support their positions because it was the only thing that opponents saw as credible. Hackers liked using the saying, "Just because you have eyes doesn't mean you can see." This was a modern reference to Jesus critically attacking the Pharisees. That was totally inbounds for him to do, but lambs often acted like it was illegal to say anything that might be perceived as critical of their religion. This was also the result of psychological engineering. It was a layer of sensitivity designed to protect and reinforce the dogma, a white blood cell treating opponents as if they were an enemy combatant bent on their destruction. So even though Jesus did it in order to expose falseness and religious exploitation in his own religion, any attempt to expose their own hypocrisies were construed as evil. The Pharisees were whited sepulchers, wearing a mask of goodness and righteousness and representing God on the outside, while inside they were zombies. They thought they were fundamentally different because they were following Jesus, but they were fundamentally the same. Jesus wasn't attacking his own religion, but rather the human beings using it to their own ends. This wasn't a vulnerability in one religion, but all religions. They needed to be exposed because they were corrupt and creating an institution out of their corruption, which would give people something to believe in, but that was lying to them for their own greed and power. In other words, the Pharisees was using the concept of God's law to socially engineer the minds of the people. Aside from religious Pharisees, who were also those called zealots, who wanted to be free from Rome and used the religion, even the concept of the Messiah, to call people to fight against Rome. In religion, it wasn't about what one could prove, but what one could get others to believe. Once the seed of belief, even one as small as a mustard seed, had taken root, the ideas contained within the seed were able to grow and spread. Oftentimes, it was good because it motivated good deeds. However, it was balanced by the evil deeds of corrupt intent. Both the person doing good and the person doing evil believed that they were right. Hackers saw both sides of this, and whenever stories came out in order to malign groups like the Exteans, hackers often got involved, doing their own investigation and exposing the lies of the church that they called programs. Relating the religion's use of biblical authority as a computer program, they would call commands from the operating system, which had the authority / access to operate the hardware. Religious leaders were often fakes, preaching goodness and devotion one day while cheating on their wives and sinning other days. Sometimes the preaching was the sin because they knew they were lying and planting seeds in the mind in order to motivate people to donate as much money to them as possible. Efforts to expose them often led to hackers being falsely called Exteans. Many people were in poverty only as a result of the church allowing them to give so much of what they had without them having investments and savings, which were important for their financial health. Often the giver didn't even realize that they were giving up the very resources that they would need to retire or make sure their children could get a decent education. They thought by giving, it would ultimately bless their lives, when in reality, goodness in their lives was in spite of their giving. There was a good side of giving, which was the ability to give, to be generous, and not so in love with money that you couldn't help others. Unfortunately, these virtues were used against them to extort more and more money as the church built more and more expensive buildings in order to attract more and manipulate more givers, the majority of who would never question where all that money was going. Zealot X was theoretically a person. He was a being defined by different agendas, a transubstantiation of the fears of those who wanted to thwart his purpose and color his intent. He was an amalgamation of ideas and symbols used by different people, crafting a mythology that at one point came to life. The rumors and conspiracy theories did as much to hide the man as did his own actions. People said they saw him like people who claim to see UFOs. They saw something their minds couldn't quite perceive, and their imaginations filled in the gaps. Likewise, people saw the shape and form of a man, and the identification was infused by a program that was spreading, becoming legend. Because no one knew his face, the idea spread that if you saw his face, he would not let you live. Some said no one knew his face, because he didn't have a face. It was blank. Or his face was so burned away by acid or fire that it simply couldn't be identified. One person even said that he was so holy that to look into his eyes would make a sinner spontaneously combust. No one even knew the difference between what was in their own heads versus what was actually known fact. The two things had merged. Hackers formed a head, martial artists formed a body, and religious fanaticism formed a heart. Could these have actually given birth to a man? Or were they simply the figments of human imagination that had been given life by all who spoke his name?